from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've done radio shows from a lot of places where maybe radio shows haven't been done before, including some radio stations. But I think today takes the cake. I'm broadcasting from the former Paramutual window at a currently closed racetrack in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hello from New Orleans, Louisiana. Yes, it's the Fairgrounds racetrack, which has been approved for the resumption of horse racing. That's what they race here. It's a novel idea. This coming season, and the season in New Orleans always begins. They didn't have racing this past year for reasons obvious. The season always begins with a peculiarly New Orleans tradition, which is the opening day of racing is Thanksgiving Day. So just before going over to the family, people come to the racetrack. There's a brass band on the infield. There's turkey, if you want it, and there's what is it called? Gambling? Yeah, so that's the way to spend a Thanksgiving Day. Anyway, I'm at the former Paramutual window, so for at least today, this will be the Paramutual broadcasting system, and some old business first. A couple months ago, I talked about the unfortunate situation in which a United Airlines stewardess, flight attendant, excuse me, forgot what decade I'm living in, inadvertently poured wine into my computer, thereby killing it. And we had a little conversation over the approved method on United Airlines for taking the bottle and applying the liquid from the bottle to the glass of the passenger. Whether you take the glass from the passenger, bring it over to the cart, refill it there, and return it to the passenger or not. And I mentioned the United Airlines stewardess, flight attendant I was talking to, said, oh, no, we were trained that that's very rude to take a glass once it's been drunk from by a passenger. I'm in receipt this week of an email. Dear Harry, having flown a fair amount on KLM Airlines, I can detail the coffee refill process is as follows. The cabin attendant politely asks the passenger to place the cup on a small tray that the attendant places in front of him. With the cup on tray, the tray is brought to the aisle, and while the coffee is poured from the opposite hand, the tray is handed back for the passenger to receive. Of course, that tray is a budget item. Poets of our time, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, the racetrack is being used for a musical event this weekend. That's why I'm here, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. Also attended and performed at, I think would be the correct turn of phrase, on Friday by Bob Dylan, poet of our time, who was quoted in his autobiography as saying of this city, there are a lot of places I like, but I like New Orleans better. There's 1,000 different angles at any moment. It's a great place to really hit on things. Poet of our times, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Dylan. And you know that the President of the United States has weighed in on the roaring controversy surrounding the release of a Spanish language version of the national anthem. The President having said he thinks the national anthem should be sung in English, to which I think more than one American has responded, presidential statement should be made in English. But I think the president is on to something, actually. I think he's right. I think it's just a start. And I think we in the radio profession should do our part. So I call on all the radio stations around the country, the Clear Channels, the Infinities of the world, to refuse to play La Vida Loca until Ricky Martin re-records it in English. I want to hear The Crazy Life. And Pete Seeger, next time you sing Guantanamera, it better damn well be in English. Hello, welcome to the show.
I'm gonna need you. shoes. When I get to walking these blues, when I get back to New Orleans, got my suitcase in my hand. Now ain't that a shame? I'm leaving here today. I'm back on home to stay. I'm walking to New Orleans.
Standing at the door, 95. Thank God I'm alive. Harry, I had no idea you were there.
Well, I guess that's because you didn't listen to the opening monologue from the former Paramutual window of the New Orleans Fairgrounds racetrack. I'm Harry Scherer, welcoming in New Orleans, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Harry Scherer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And now, news from outside the bubble. Good. It's bubblicious this week, I'll tell you. General Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan, facing a surge of anti-American sentiment. Why would that be? This week warned that covert U.S. airstrikes against al-Qaeda inside Pakistan were an infringement of his national sovereignty. That's our friend, ladies and gentlemen. There's al-Qaeda inside Pakistan? Admitting that his popularity was waning, the Pakistani president insisted he was not a poodle of George Bush and rejected accusations he was running a military dictatorship. He overthrew the elected president 5 or 6 years ago, and he's a general. But it's not a military dictatorship. Speaking to the British newspaper The Guardian, weeks after a tense visit by the U.S. president to Pakistan that brought down a torrent of criticism in his own country, General Musharraf insisted he's his own man. It's not a question of being a poodle. I'm nobody's poodle, he said. I have enough strength of my own to lead. He pledged to hold free and fair elections next year, as urged by George Bush. It's ironic, he says. Oh, he seized power in 1999, yes. It's ironic that I'm sitting in uniform talking of democracy, he says, but to bring democracy into Pakistan, I thought I needed it, he said. Pakistan faces criticism from the U.S. and Afghanistan for not doing enough to flush extremists from its tribal areas. Musharraf insisted in his interview there was no question of Pakistan submitting to American scrutiny and said claims that his government acted at Washington's bidding were nonsense. He added there's a growing problem of Talibanization in the tribal area of Pakistan known as Waziristan. Talibanization, ladies and gentlemen. Perv is nobody's poodle. Now, to the U.S. State Department, in reports that made very little news here, but made big news outside the bubble, hence the name of the feature, the U.S. State Department acknowledged that there is a risk of Iran becoming a safe haven for terrorists 3 years after the invasion of the country. The warning is contained in the State Department's annual report on terrorism. The report documents an increase in terrorist attacks worldwide, and it appears, says the British newspaper, The Guardian, to undermine repeated claims by President Bush that the U.S. is winning the war on terrorism. The report says, quote, Iraq is not currently a terrorist safe haven, but terrorists view Iraq as a potential safe haven and are attempting to make it a reality. the British newspaper The Times, owned by Rupert Murdoch, headlines that U.S. admits Iraq is terror cause. The U.S. administration acknowledged that the war has become a cause for Islamic extremists worldwide and that there is a risk of the country becoming a safe haven. So it's, the figures in the State Department's annual report on terror represent a four-fold rise in terrorist incidents worldwide compared with 2004. We, I think, had that on last week. Elsewhere outside the bubble, more. Sure, there's more. Dateline, Canada. Yes, Canada is not the United States, but sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. The Canadian media will be barred from an Ontario airfield this week when the bodies of four Canadian soldiers killed in Afghanistan over the weekend arrive home. The Conservative government's decision to keep the public from seeing the images of flag-draped coffins follows the announcement that the Peace Tower flag, I guess that's a flag in Canada, will not be flown at half-mast to mark the deaths of the soldiers. The Peace Tower flag will instead only be lowered once a year on Remembrance Day until it's changed, until they forget. The move mirrors the practice that's controversial in the United States, as we know. And has prompted opposition critics to accuse the new Canadian government of trying to hide the human cost of Canada's mission in Afghanistan. But Canada, ladies and gentlemen, is nobody's poodle. It's our shih tzu. Up to 12 billion dollars will be wiped off property values if the British government accepts the advice of experts that homes should... Now, see if this rings a long-distant bell. Something you heard a long time ago on another planet. If the British government accepts the advice of experts that homes should no longer be built near overhead power lines because of possible links to childhood leukemia. This is in this week's Telegraph newspaper in Britain. 130,000 houses could lose between 10% and a quarter of their resale value if ministers, meaning government officials, take up the advice of a committee set up by the Department of Health. A draft of a report by the committee states that building houses within 230 feet of high-voltage power lines and 115 feet of lower voltage power lines should be banned. The confidential document considers the option of compulsorily buying all 75,000 homes in the UK that are affected. But the group's preferred option is an end to the building of houses near overhead lines and a ban on new power lines being built near existing houses. Children under 15 living near high voltage power lines, says Dr. Gerald Draper of the Oxford Childhood Cancer Research Group, could have a 69%, I don't know what he means by could have, a 69% increased risk of getting leukemia. Some scientists pointed out that while the research found a statistical association, it did not establish a causal link, and they rejected the findings. So let's not get scared yet. But there is this. Finally, outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you wondering, what's Wolfie been doing lately? Paul Wolfowitz, one of the architects of the Iraq War, as you may remember, fled the scene in Washington a little while ago to become head of the World Bank, mirroring the career move of Robert McNamara, who was the architect of the Vietnam War. So it's a well-marked career path. So this from a British newspaper, The Guardian: the World Bank, leader in the global effort to control malaria, has been accused of deception and medical malpractice by a group of public health doctors for failing to carry out its funding promises and wrongly claiming its programs have been successful at cutting the death toll from the disease. The serious charges are leveled by Amir Attaran, a professor at the Institute of Population Health and Faculty of Law at Ottawa University, and colleagues from around the world. Writing for the Lancet Medical Journal, they say the World Bank is unfit to lead global efforts to control the disease. It kills around 1 million people a year. They say the World Bank has not delivered the $300 to $500 million in funding it promised to Africa when it launched its ambitious global roll-back malaria campaign, which was intended to cut malaria deaths in this decade in half. They add that it has not been open about the amounts it is spending on malaria, and that it has wasted money and endangered lives by allowing countries to buy malarial drugs that no longer work. The bank's response, published by Lancet Online, acknowledges it should have done more in the past, but says its current programs are well-funded, well-staffed, and delivering results. So, Paul Wolfowitz, ladies and gentlemen, nice people doing nice things. News from outside the bubble, the copyrighted feature of this particular broadcast. And there is news about Iraq that has penetrated the bubble to a certain extent, but you might not have been aware of it yet. The Washington Post reports today that U.S. military officials and security experts find themselves in a vigorous debate over an idea that just months ago was largely dismissed as a fringe thought, that the surest and perhaps now the only way to bring stability to Iraq, hands? Any guesses? Is to divide the country into three pieces. I believe it was on this broadcast that I opined some time back that Iraq was not going to be the new Vietnam. It was going to be the new Yugoslavia. And here we go. Those who see the partitioning of Iraq as increasingly attractive argue that separating the Shiites, Sunnis and Kurds may be the only solution to the violence that many experts believe verges on civil war. Others contend it would simply lead to new and dangerous challenges for the United States. One specialist on the Iraqi insurgency, Ahmed Hashim, a professor at the U.S. Navy War College, contends in a new book that the U.S. government's options are closing to just two: let a civil war occur, or avoid that outcome through some sort of partition. By the way, the Iraqi politicians have ended a four-month impasse by choosing a prime minister. Now all they need is a government. That purple ink is fading. The fundamental fact of Iraq is that insurgent attacks on Iraqi police and army troops continue unabated, says Jeffrey White, a former Defense Intelligence Agency analyst. Also, he says there's been a spate of worrisome large-scale direct attacks on Iraqi police stations. So, divide them up. Like it used to be. Because let's remember, ladies and gentlemen, Iraq has been Iraq since the end of World War I. I know, it's been around. Mesopotamia and such. Babylon. But as Iraq, thank the Brits. They drew the lines. So maybe they were wrong. Now, also, these two items, which need to be brought to your attention in tandem for their comic value. Dateline Washington, an American initiative to use private security companies to protect Iraq's oil and power infrastructure, collapsed amid reports of possible fraud, missing weapons, and destroyed documents, according to a federal audit reported in the Los Angeles Dog Trainer. The program was named Task Force Shield. The U.S. paid two security firms $147 million, chicken feed, to train and equip tens of thousands of Iraqis to safeguard oil pipelines and transmission powers. The U.S. government's efforts, quote, ultimately proved to be unsuccessful, says the report by the Special Inspector General for the Reconstruction of Iraq. He's going to be busy. Quote, the lack of records and equipment accountability raises significant concerns about possible fraud, waste, and abuse by U.S. and Iraqi officials. Task Force Shield was disbanded in April 2005. Its former commanders could not be reached for comment on Saturday. Hey, Saturday's a good golf day. The chief executive of Erinys, E-R-I-N-Y-S, the company responsible for training guards to protect Iraq's oil system, strenuously defended its work, saying it had fulfilled all the terms of its contract and delivered a functioning security force. Officials with ASARS, a green-built Maryland company hired to protect Iraq's electrical grid, could not be reached for comment. The audit is the latest account of poor oversight by the United States in the reconstruction of Iraq, an effort plagued by reports of billions of dollars of waste, fraud, and abuse. Now, lest you think that the government is not concerned about its money, comes this. Nearly 900 soldiers wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan have been saddled with government debt as they've recovered from the war. A report describes collection notices going out to veterans with brain damage, paralysis, lost limbs, and shrapnel wounds. The report by the Government Accountability Office details how long-recognized problems with military computer systems led to the soldiers being dunned for an array of debts related to everything from errors in paychecks to equipment left behind on the battlefield. Soldiers' complaints began to surface last year. Several lawmakers have become involved. The new report shows a problem more widespread than previously known. Hundreds of separated battle-injured soldiers were pursued for collection of military debts incurred through no fault of their own, the report said. The figures show 900 battle-wounded troops tagged with debt. It's unconscionable, says Ryan Kelly, a retired staff sergeant who lost a leg to a roadside bomb and then spent more than a year trying to fend off a debt of $2,200. It's sad that we'd let that happen. The underlying problem, want to say this together, an antiquated computer system for paying and tracking members of the military. Pay records are not integrated with personnel records, creating numerous errors. So, we may have lost billions in the training of Iraqi security guards, but we're getting it back one injured American soldier at a time.
This little place a time or two before, and I liked the words they had painted on the door.
Social, social and pleasure.
Are they drinking? Are they dancing? Are they having a ball? Are they making plans for the next Mardi Gras?
Well, that's social, social and
more of. I heard a rhythm from some drumming that was coming from within. I smelled the catfish fry. You know something's cooking
at the social, social lady pleasure club.
Now, from the home of Larry King Live, here's Larry King Live.
We're coming to you from New York City, where I'm going to be hosting the Mesothelioma Foundation's Lingerie for Lungs Fashion Gala this Friday night. In our Los Angeles studio, an old friend, even though he's still a youngster in our business and in life itself, the fabulous singer who became an icon of the 90s as part of the superstar boy band Boys Are Us. He's been going solo for the last 6 years. Dewey Gordon. Dewey, welcome back to Larry King Live.
Thanks, Mr. Live. Mr. King.
Hey, I hope I'm still Mr. Live.
You always will be, even on the reruns. But it's great to be back with you. We miss you out here.
Hey, tell the gang at Nate and Al's I'll be back before the corn rye gets any staler.
Will do. That's the place on Beverly?
Dewey, you've always been involved in causes and doing good for others and trying to help your career in that way. You got something new cooking now?
Yes, sir, Mr. King, and thank you for the kind mention. You know, I think even when you're not getting that much from the public, or maybe even especially then, that it's still important to give something back. I'm not going to come on here and kid your audience. The last couple of CDs from Dewey Gordon have been work that I've been very proud of, but what's really been rewarding to me have been the tours over to Iraq.
Yeah, you were the first solo ex-member of a boy band to go over there to entertain our troops, weren't you?
Yes, sir, I had that privilege. Yeah. You know, I wish sometimes that there were a lot more of my colleagues who could take time out from dating movie stars and being in the magazines to give a little something of themselves. But, you know, maybe if I were in their shoes and still selling records, you know, I'd be doing what they're doing. I'm not here to judge.
No, you leave that to the jury. Dewey, on your latest Goodwill tour, you're not leaving the country. Do I got that right?
You sure do, Mr. King. Mm. There were management issues between my people and the folks running the Iraq tours. They wanted free download rights to anything we performed that were recorded south of Baghdad. And we said no way, and they said,
yeah, well, whatever they said, you're back here, you're safe, and you're still entertaining the military.
It's interesting. I'm entertaining the retired military, specifically the retired generals. You know, they've been getting a lot of attention recently, a lot of flack, a lot of press.
Hey, couldn't hurt you to get some of that.
No, sir. But, you know, these are gentlemen who've given years of service to their country, and we thought, golly, nobody's organizing a show for them.
Yeah, these are concerts or what?
You know, it runs the whole gamut. Some of them are concerts where that can be put together. In some cases, they're house parties, whatever works to bring some folks together to pay tribute to however many retired generals may be in a given community. And to say, whatever your book says or you say about whatever, we still just want to thank you and salute you and to present an exclusive debut performance of our latest song, Stars on Your Shoulder.
So you're not taking sides and saying this retired general is right and that one is less right or anything like that?
No, sir. I mean, you know, I am in show business. Obviously, I get a lot of information from people, you know, that most people don't see. But still, I'm no military expert or anything, but, you know, and I know it's not like getting shot at, but these guys, they gave 20 or 30 years of their lives, and now they're saying things or writing things, and other people are saying things and writing things about them, and maybe it's time just to take time out and say, hey, thank you.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, some other folks in the business are too busy or too whatever, but, you know, Dewey Gordon.
No, you're busy, but you're not too busy.
Dewey Gordon is not too busy to care, is I guess what Dewey's trying to say.
Now, you mentioned the song.
Yes, sir. Stars on Your Shoulder. I wrote it and recorded it with the great hip-hop producer Thugbone.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry we couldn't get the video over to you today, but there was a mix-up with the guns.
Well, maybe you could just sing a little bit of it for us a cappella go.
Well, I guess I'd be glad to, Mr. King. Yeah. Stars on your shoulder, steel in your stare. You lead, I'll follow. You do what you dare.
Yeah.
And there's just a killer beat track behind it and some girls.
That's great. By the way, you're almost 40 years old, Dewey. You don't got to call me Mr. King anymore. Tomorrow night, an important panel on health care for Liza Minnelli. Dewey, I know if I was a retired general, having a Dewey Gordon come to entertain me would be pretty special.
Well, we hope so, Larry. So far, the response has been amazing. Yeah. I mean, you'd be surprised how many retired generals there are out there and how many people in their communities want to come out and pay tribute to them.
I would be surprised if you told me how many there were. Tomorrow, the Attorney General of Aruba on what he doesn't know about the Natalie Holloway case and your phone calls. Dewey, you got to come back next time you're in town.
Thanks, Larry. I live here.
The great Dewey Gordon, Anderson Cooper, is next from New York. Good night.
love when we want to kiss. We kiss with a little petting. We're getting some fun out of life. When we want to work, we work. When we want to play, we play. In our happy setting, we're getting some fun out of life. Maybe we'll do the right thing. Maybe we'll do the wrong. Spending each day, wending our way along. Now, 'cause when we want to sing, we sing. When we want to dance, we dance. You can do your betting. We're getting some fun out of life.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
We start at the top with heads of state and government. Nepal's embattled monarch this week made a humiliating televised climb down. When he ordered the reinstatement of parliament, the key demand of anti-monarchist protesters. After 19 days of street protests that paralyzed the Himalayan kingdom, a contrite king, Jainendra, made a last attempt to avert further bloodshed and shave his throne. Don't shave your throne, sir. You don't need to do that to please me. Looking tense and gray, the king apologized to his subjects for the deaths of 14 demonstrators and gave in to the key demand of the alliance opposed to his rule. So the king apologized, ladies and gentlemen, and didn't shave his throne. Dateline Australia, Prime Minister John Howard says he feels, quote, desperately sorry, unquote, for the family of the first Australian soldier to die in Iraq after a major bungle. Have you heard about this story? In which the wrong body was returned to Australia. The head of Australia's Defence Force has also described the mix-up as, quote, totally unacceptable. Yeah, I'd say that's right. Returned the wrong body, the first Australian soldier killed. Private contractors are being blamed for the mistake, which resulted in another soldier's body being flown to Australia. Someone else's body was flown from Kuwait instead of Private Jake Kovko. Howard said he felt desperately sorry for what had happened to the family. I feel desperately sorry for Mrs. Kovko. I do. I still do. I said so. He said on the radio. Howard, the Prime Minister, said Private Kovko's wife was very angry about the bungle. She was very distressed. She was very angry. She was very upset. And all of that is totally understandable. Howard expressed sorrow to the entire Kovko family. Mr. Howard said it was almost impossible to believe that the wrong body had been shipped back to Australia. Quote, it's one of those things that you never dreamed could happen. You think it's tragic enough that the poor man's life has been lost, and then on top of that, you have this. Howard said no blame could be laid at the feet of the Army for the mix-up. We'll figure out. It's too late. It's either too late or too early to point fingers. Dateline London, British Prime Minister Tony Blair stood by his beleaguered Home Secretary. That's like the Interior Secretary this week, refusing to let Charles Clarke resign despite revelations that his office had set free more than 1,000 foreign prisoners who should have been deported after serving their sentences. I do apologize. I have apologized. I continue to do so, Clarke told Parliament. Clarke insisted it was up to him to sort out the problem that was of his making. And a waitress at a Washington bar said British Prime Minister Tony Blair's oldest son was intoxicated and tried to burn his table with candles. Becky Brash, a 26-year-old waitress at Madam's Organ Blues Bar, said Ewan Blair repeatedly asked for more candles on the table and didn't stop when she told him not to light the table on fire. The 22-year-old, eldest son of the Prime Minister, confronted Brash because she didn't know who he was, but quickly backed down when she talked back to him. He apologized and was allowed to stay, Brash said. Sharon Stone has accepted an undisclosed sum in libel damages from a British newspaper that alleged she'd left her 4-year-old son in a car while dining at a London restaurant. A lawyer for the owners of the Daily Mail told a judge the newspaper now accepts that the allegation was untrue and apologized to Stone for the distress and embarrassment that it had caused. A man who tried to parachute from the Empire State Building insisted he was only trying to live out a high-flying fantasy. A day after being snatched from the edge of the 86th floor observation deck, Jeb Corliss. Does that sound like a real name? I ask you. Jeb Corliss tried to paint himself as a law-abiding citizen who for 2 years had mapped out each step of his planned plunge into Fifth Avenue at rush hour. I am a base jumper, bridge, antenna, span, and earth. That's what I do. One of my dreams was flying off the Empire State Building. I know the feeling. The TV stunt show stars. Oh, really? Fantasy was foiled when cops and security guards nabbed him more than 1,000 feet above the city streets. And then he got canned by the Discovery Channel, on which he hosted Stunt Junkies. The network said it had no clue about his plan, even though Corliss came equipped with an expensive camera to film his descent. He wore a phony mustache and a fat suit into the building before slipping into a restroom and donning his parachute. Discovery Channel said in a statement, "We are beyond disappointed at his serious lack of judgment and his reckless behavior." The 30-year-old daredevil from California did apologize for creating a stir above the city's most famous building and said he received wonderful treatment from the New York Police Department, but he added that his future stunts would take place elsewhere. Quote, "I am finished with New York as far as base jumping is concerned," Corliss said. Man, do I know that feeling. Minneapolis City Pages editor Steve Perry apologized for naming crystal meth as best cheap thrill in the alternative paper's Best of Roundup. He noted the item was mainly satiric in intent. Again, amateurs using humor. at their own peril. Officials at the Highland School near Birmingham, Alabama, apologized this week to parents who were upset when their children sang a Confederate marching song during a fifth grade history presentation. One parent says she's still not happy. At least five black students sang, along with their classmates, the lyrics of "The Bonnie Blue Flag" at the conclusion of the program, while one held a cardboard replica of the blue flag with a single white star used by some Confederate states. The school's interim head sent an email to all parents at the private school apologizing for any offense given. The display of a flag and the lyrics in the song angered several of our families, he said, and for this, I am deeply sorry. I promise you we will be ever diligent to make sure incidents like this, or as he says, incidences like this, will not happen again. The history teacher who designed the program apologized and explained his decision to have the children sing the song and another about Abraham Lincoln. But one mother said the letters saddened her because they showed the school didn't grasp why black parents would be offended. I really wasn't looking for an apology, she said. There's nothing they could have sung after that song short of "We Shall Overcome," and I think I'd still be angry, she added. Japanese Prime Minister, boy, it's head of state week on the apologies of the week. Must be politically advantageous to apologize. Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi of Japan, and of course I slaughtered his name, issued the first formal apology by a prime minister for his country's failure to deal properly with Minamata disease, one of the worst pollution-caused maladies and one that erupted during the nation's speedy economic growth of the 1950s. Are you listening, China? Quote, the government feels a deep responsibility and offers a frank apology for failing to take appropriate steps for a long period of time to prevent the spread of Minamata disease, said his statement, which was read by a flunky. The apology just comes ahead of Monday's 50th anniversary of the first recognized report of the disease caused by environmental mercury poisoning by a company called Chiso. We should never allow pollution-related diseases to occur in the future, Koizumi told reporters later in the day. Not clear whether the reporters laughed or not. In a letter distributed to shareholders, General Motors Chairman and CEO Rick Wagoner has apologized for the company's highly publicized accounting errors and promised the automaker is moving aggressively to strengthen internal accounting. You know, the Harvard University sophomore with a highly publicized first novel acknowledged she had borrowed material accidentally from another author's work, and she has apologized. I sincerely apologize to Megan McCafferty and to any who feel they have been misled by these unintentional errors on my part. Well, that's sophomoric behavior. It's appropriate. And Philadelphia City Councilman, I think, you know, one baseball apology. Mets broadcaster Keith Hernandez was reprimanded by the team's television network for inappropriate remarks during a broadcast about a female member of San Diego's training staff, meaning the Padres, not the city. The former first baseman said women, quote, don't belong in the dugout when he spotted 33-year-old Kelly Calabrese, the Padres' full-time massage therapist, high-fiving Mike Piazza in the dugout. Most painful place to be high-fived, incidentally. After Hernandez found out later in the broadcast that she was with the Padres' training staff, he repeated that she shouldn't have been there. I won't say that women belong in the kitchen, but they don't belong in the dugout, he said. Hernandez then laughed and said, you know I'm only teasing. I love you gals out there. Always have. Quote, Keith Hernandez made inappropriate comments regarding the presence of a female massage therapist of the San Diego Padres who was in the dugout, said Sportsnet New York, his broadcast employer. We immediately addressed the issue with Keith and reprimanded him, and he publicly apologized during Sunday's game. Hey, what an apology it was, too. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. Priorities, ladies and gentlemen. Acting on what a lawmaker called an agreed-on arrangement between billboard lobbyists and local governments, the Florida State Legislature sent Jeb Bush a bill this week that will prevent trees from being planted in front of billboards. Let's get scared for just a moment. In the past year, two New Jersey laboratories have been unable to account for plague-infested mice and vials of deadly anthrax spores. Top state officials are scrambling to devise better ways to safeguard deadly material. In both cases, authorities say that think the items in question weren't actually lost, but were simply unaccounted for due to clerical errors, although they can't say for sure. The mice have never been located. Officials say the rodents might have been stolen or eaten by other lab animals. Well, that's okay if you eat plague-infected mice, isn't it? That's healthy. That's good for you. Ladies and gentlemen, you know that President Bush delivered a speech this week to a renewable energy conference in which he renewed his call, and I believe he was using the English language, although reports differ on that. He renewed his call for more efforts. Like, why does he call for them? He could do them. To move the country toward... He was pitching for ethanol particularly because apparently some people who process ethanol into... process corn into ethanol give large amounts of money to both political parties. But so he left out the possibility of importing ethanol from Brazil, which makes it from sugarcane cheaper than you can make it from corn. But in any way, in any case, he was renewing his call for alternative, renewable, non-oil energy. Because, ladies and gentlemen, as he's pointed out now more than once, we are addicted to oil. This was part of his campaign to deflect criticism as oil prices spike above $3. And, you know, speech is fine, but as I've said before, what the man needs is a song.
You know what problem's rising faster than an overdose of yeast? It's the way that we depend on the bad old Middle East. It's full of sheiks and Shiites. Keep things on the boil. God, I hate to say it, we're addicted to oil. God, I hate to say it, we're addicted to oil. Believe me when I tell you, addiction is no fun. It always ends up leading to a foreigner and a gun. Why don't we bring our problems home to native soil? Never gonna do it while we're addicted to oil. No, never gonna do it while we're addicted to oil. Just get me right, don't get me wrong. There's a reason why I didn't see the truth for so long. 'Cause I'm an oil man. Just an oil man. My pie hole was just a dry hole. Sometimes you kick the habit, sometimes it kicks back. So I'm not gonna promise we'll always stay on track. Why have the turkey cold when you can set it to broil? Can't say that I don't love it, we're addicted to oil. Yeah, can't say that I don't love it, we're addicted to oil. Fill her up, boys. In a turnip, you can't pee up a rope. The minute that we started, we were on that slippery slope. The problem with solutions is they take too much toil. It's like a kind of sickness, we're addicted to oil. It's like a kind of sickness, we're addicted to oil. Just get me right, don't get me wrong. There's a reason why I didn't see the truth for so long. 'Cause I'm an oil man. Just an oil man. Yeah, my pie hole was like a dry hole. My problem's rising faster than an overdose of yeast. It's the way that we depend on that bad old Middle East. It's full of sheiks and Shiites who keep things on the boil. God, I hate to say it, we're addicted to oil. Lord, I hate to say it, we're addicted to oil. You know it hurts so much to say it, we're addicted to oil.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe and the USN 440 cable system in Japan, on the mighty 104 FM in Berlin, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via WBCQ, the planet, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshear.com, kcrw.com, available at channel 134, is it now, on Sirius Satellite Radio, I can't keep track. And available as a free download at www.audible.com/theshow and available as a free podcast. Sign up. Just get it shoved into your computer at kcrw.com. And it'll be just like racing, starting again, right behind me at this track, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at innerworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack, a tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks, also to Damon Jacob, Robert Carroll, and the ineffable David Friedman of WWOZ in New Orleans for making today's program possible. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.